It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin business owners and investors are keeping a close eye on the tariff roller coaster, with some of President Trump's tariffs going up, others put on pause for 90 days.
And high-tech businesses in fields like biotechnology, health information, and computer sciences are watching for the impact of cuts in federal research funding here in the state.
Tom Still is keeping a close eye on these issues. He's president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good morning, Rob and Kate, and good morning to your listeners as well.
And Tom, you wrote about tariff uncertainty before President Trump announced sweeping across-the-board tariffs last week, postponed them yesterday. You've been talking to business leaders here in the state. What are you hearing from them about tariffs and their future planning?
Well, your description of a roller coaster is exactly right. I mean, we're not out of the woods yet on this issue at all, even though the president rolled back some of the tariffs yesterday. I think what we're hearing is that there has to be a recognition that so many of the country's jobs are tied to trade. Something like 41 million jobs in the United States alone, probably 690,000 of those in Wisconsin, you know, one way or the other through the supply chain. And I think people are concerned for good reason, because the way it came down initially from the president really didn't allow any time for planning. And, you know, perhaps he's reading his own polls and listening to his advisors and pulled back a bit. But there's still a fair amount of uncertainty out there. And I think the markets this morning are reflecting that as well.
One of the arguments for tariffs, including from the president himself, is that put in place, they'll encourage more companies to manufacture more stuff ultimately here in the United States. What do you make of that argument, given the way these tariffs have rolled out?
Some of that is true. Excuse me. Some of that is true. But in other ways, it's not. You know, a lot of folks started doing manufacturing in places like China because of cost, you know, cheaper labor. But really today, it's as much about their engineering prowess and their manufacturing prowess as anything. And so, you know, some companies are kind of almost doubling down on what they're doing in China. Could it help? Sure. I think especially for nascent industries and companies, that's where tariffs probably can be great for protecting a fledgling industry. But otherwise, it may not make that much of a difference in terms of reshoring. It can in some cases and can in some sectors, but not especially overall.
I've seen arguments that the Trump administration is undercutting that argument, the argument that tariffs will bring back manufacturing, by also saying, well, this is sort of a club. This is going to beat people into making better deals with us and open up even freer trade. So that in a sense says, don't plan on bringing businesses back to America, because these tariff rates will change as these negotiations go on. Is that kind of uncertainty going to affect planning for, hey, where am I going to build my next factory?
Well, I think it can. And that's what, you know, what we've been seeing in the markets certainly is the uncertainty. Markets don't like that. And I think most manufacturers, most businesses don't like that either. They can adjust and when they know what the rules are and what the playing field looks like. So, you know, in this state, I think we're vulnerable in a couple of ways. You know, we do some things in the supply chains around pharmaceuticals, around medical equipment, obviously, auto supplies, machine shops. Those kinds of things are more vulnerable in Wisconsin than perhaps some other states. And, of course, our farm economy. Food manufacturing is a big deal in Wisconsin, and exporting that food, obviously we can't eat it all here, and exporting that food to different places around the world makes sense. So, I think the uncertainty of what's been going on is what has touched his manufacturers and others pretty directly.
Tom, you mentioned supply chains earlier, and we hear when people talk about, for example, Michigan and auto production there, the same auto part might be between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. produced in one country with raw materials from another country, cross borders a couple times as different steps in the process go on. Do we have comparable supply chains in Wisconsin where we're seeing cross-border reliance on these parts?
Yes, absolutely. And you mentioned Canada and Mexico, and you're exactly right there. It's auto supply chains in Wisconsin are historic and pretty well established, and so it's definitely true that we have that in the parts chain in Wisconsin as much as anyone.
Tom Still is with us from the Wisconsin Technology Council, talking about big economic issues at the federal level that could affect Wisconsin business. And from tariffs, Tom, I want to turn to another issue you're watching, federal research funding. We hear cuts, of course, in grants from the National Institutes for Health and other funding organizations. What are you watching for? What kind of impacts are you worried about here in Wisconsin?
Very deep impacts. In, you know, some of the recent figures I've seen would suggest that Wisconsin alone has probably somewhere around $690 million a year in grants from NIH, National Institutes of Health. And so the talk about really getting rid of a part of those grants, I think, is really significant for places like, the UW-Madison, Medical College of Wisconsin, Blood Center of Wisconsin, Versatile is called now, Marquette, Marshfield Clinic. Those are places that have done cutting edge research in health for decades, and if not longer. And so it's really, you know, important from that root source of research to make sure that that funding does continue. And then from a patient view, over time, we've seen remarkable discoveries come out of Wisconsin that are health related. And that of course, is affects people everywhere, not just here. So we're watching that closely and hope to do some things additionally through our events that put a focus on that.
That's the research and the patient side of things, both important. Connect the dots for us, Tom, between that kind of research and businesses, new business startups and spinoffs here in the state.
Well, when you look, let's just use one example. The Tide to Wharf, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, and a business that it invested in about 30 years ago, maybe 31. It led to an investment in a company that over time, the folks who came out of that, and by the way, it was a successful company, folks who came out of that went on to start other companies, Exact Sciences, for example. And so you see the research that is adopted in certain sectors and then just grows from there and becomes more almost like its own little virus in terms of growing and adding to the economy. So those kinds of jobs are really important, and that kind of economic growth is important.
Do you worry that future business startups could be impacted then if this research isn't happening, isn't being funded here in the state?
Yes. I mean, it won't go away entirely, obviously. But yes, I am I am worried about that look at, for example, GE Healthcare and magnetic resonance imaging. That was developed over time, and NIH funds were a part of it, and it's become a major source of jobs and everything else in Wisconsin, but also health. The ability to use these MRI machines and in different ways and more innovative ways has led to that kind of business, and I think we're going to continue to see that. It's the combination of what the effect would be on human health as well as business here in Wisconsin, because we're kind of outsized in that way. Compared to, we're not as big as a California, for example, or some other places I could name, Massachusetts. But at the same time, we're pretty outsized among the states. And I think our kind of employment here that's driven by this is really significant.
On a related note, UW, especially UW-Madison, brings in a lot of international students with recent revocations of their student visas. It's raising questions. Are we going to lure international students to the state? Are we going to lure international researchers who may not be sure about things like immigration, green card, work visa, research visa status? Is that something you have your eye on?
Yes, although I think we'll always be a magnet. I think some of that is more or less happening around the edge versus having a direct impact. You know, when you look at some of these institutions that we discussed earlier, they're top notch. I mean, they are among the best in the country and the world. And I think we will continue to be a magnet for talent. So I think it's less about people who would want to be here legally than those who might be illegal. And so I think we're going to continue to draw that kind of talent from around the world.
Tom, as we start to wrap up, what are a couple of the biggest questions you are still trying to figure out answers for when it comes to some of these federal policies that affect Wisconsin's economy?
Well, I think the proposed cuts in a sector, I suppose, of NIH grants, that's where I think we need to focus and double down in terms of making sure that members of the congressional delegation and, in fact, the Wisconsin legislature and the executive branch here understand that, and that people understand that it's so directly tied to them. You know, you look at the amount of NIH grants that are coming into Wisconsin, and you divide that by our population, it's about $110 per year per capita. Now, that's, you know, when you think about it, that's pretty. And that's if all of the grants went away. So that's a small amount of money when you think about the what it does in terms of economic effect, but also health effect for people who are everywhere from, you know, studies of Alzheimer's disease to innovations in surgery and medical imaging, all of that.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, looking at the impact of tariffs and cuts in federal research funding on Wisconsin.
Coming up, the Wisconsin Idea Conference aims to build cooperation between university and community.
Everyone has something to teach and everyone has something to learn. And when we're doing our very best, we're sort of being changed and changing each other.
Hear from the head of the Morgridge Center for Public Service. That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On the campaign trail, President Donald Trump promised mass deportations. It was a big concern for industries that rely on the labor of workers without legal immigration status, like dairy in Wisconsin.
Now, a few months into the new administration, rhetoric is still strong, and there have been many high-profile deportations.
But as Bridget Bowden reports, Wisconsin dairy workers are carrying on as those enforcement efforts have been focused elsewhere.
Once a week on a dairy farm in Buffalo County, there's a class to help workers from Mexico learn English.
¿Cómo se dice, estoy orgulloso de mí mismo?
I am proud of myself. Mm-hmm.
Kevin is one of the students in the class tonight. We're only using the workers' first names because of their immigration status. Kevin came to Wisconsin from Mexico about 5 years ago, arriving in the January cold.
La verdad, no tenía idea de cómo era el frío aquí.
Since then, Kevin has been saving money to build a house in Mexico. He says he never feared being deported before the 2024 election, but now...
Sí, un poco. De no tener miedo, tal vez no, pero preocupante sí, porque...
He says he's a little worried, mostly about being treated badly by immigration authorities. But he's not scared, he says. He hasn't changed his day-to-day behavior at all. And for the dairy industry, that's good, because a report from UW-Madison estimates that immigrants without legal status perform about 70% of the labor on Wisconsin dairy farms. And it seems that's how a lot of dairy workers feel about the new Trump administration, says farm owner John Rosenau.
They're basing everything off of last time. He said the same thing last time, and then nothing happened. And so people aren't going home. They're staying, and they're working, and going about their daily lives, I believe.
The majority of the workers who keep Rosenau's farm running are from Mexico. He's been active in advocating for immigration reform. Unlike for seasonal agriculture workers, there's not a temporary work visa available for dairy workers who are needed year-round. Rosenau says he's hopeful the more than $50 billion the dairy industry contributes to the state's economy each year will protect dairy workers from being deported.
It just doesn't make sense that the federal government would ruin an industry by being overzealous on immigration. And we think it's rhetoric.
Some of the highest profile immigration actions under the Trump administration have been more politically motivated rather than workplace raids, like student visa holders who've been arrested and detained after participating in protests. Julia Gillette is the associate director of the U.S. program at the Migration Policy Institute. She says there are a lot of outstanding legal questions surrounding the tactics the Trump administration is using.
How those court cases proceed could determine the course of some of those activities.
And it could shape whether the administration pursues more sweeping deportations. Gillette says there have been slightly more total deportations so far than during the first Trump administration, but fewer than the first years under President Obama. She says most arrests happen when local jails turn people over to ICE. Still, she suspects that the Trump administration is planning some type of workplace enforcement effort at some point.
Those take some time to prepare, and often there's a lot of investigation that happens before the actual arrests happen, so those may be in the works.
But Gillette says it's unclear if those efforts would focus on farm workers. She says other industries, like meatpacking, have been more frequent targets in the past. While all that plays out, the cows on Rosenau's farm still have to be milked and cared for day in and day out. Ramon has been working on the farm for about 2 years. Like many dairy workers in the area, his wife and kids are back in Mexico.
Por mí no hay problema, me puede agarrar, me deporta. Pero lo que sería es el rancho.
He says for him, it wouldn't be a problem. They can deport him, but what about the farm? If all the workers were sent back to Mexico, he says, the consequences here would be devastating.
No, no más dinero, no más leche.
No more money, no more milk. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Community leaders, researchers, and public service organizations came together for the Wisconsin Idea Conference earlier this week in Madison.
The Wisconsin Idea came about in the early 1900s, inspired by former UW president John Bascom's belief that the university's service to the public was a moral obligation.
With the Trump administration's mass layoffs of federal employees working in public service, we're checking in on how the Wisconsin Idea is doing.
Travis Wright is faculty director of the Mortgage Center for Public Service and an associate professor of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison. Travis, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
The Mortgage Center is focused on building partnerships and solving these critical issues through service and learning. And right now we're seeing tens of thousands of federal workers being laid off. How do the federal layoffs and research funding cuts affect the mission at the Mortgage Center?
You know, we are concerned about the impact of the budget cuts, obviously, on the university and the community. And so we're trying to be very proactive in thinking about how to fill the gap. Now more than ever, I think it's important for campus and community to work together, to be partners, to engage in meaningful dialogue with each other. So we're doing our best to think together about in these sort of changing times, how we might continue to collaborate to make a difference in society and to help people understand in a deeper way the importance of service and connection.
Can you give an example of a community partner and what they might be going through or feeling at this moment?
Sure. So, you know, some of our partners work with folks who share minoritized identities. And so a number of our partners serve migrant communities, minoritized communities, communities that may have been experiencing reductions in funding or support, or maybe experiencing higher levels of surveillance. And so, you know, obviously this has created a lot of stress and distress for these agencies. Funding in many cases has been cut. And so community organizations are trying to do more with fewer resources. And so we've been thinking about how do we connect campus resources to these community partners that are in need and mobilize students and use sort of intellectual property of the university to help our partners kind of think about their work in different ways and to bridge the gap.
And your work, I would imagine, is oftentimes built on trust. It's built on relationships. Is that suffering when, you know, you see so many changes at the federal government and layoffs and other issues like diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Mm-hmm. What I'm finding is that, you know, because the university is experiencing a lot of threat right now, and I think many of our partner organizations are as well. And so I'm finding that this is actually in some ways sort of required us to sort of lean into each other and really rely on each other as partners. Now more than ever, our work of connecting campus and community is essential. Like, we have to build goodwill and connection with community. Just yesterday, we held our third annual Wisconsin Idea Conference, and over 300 members of campus and community came together to think about partnership and how do we deepen our connections and how do we work together more collaboratively and to continue the good work and to build on the good work that is already taking place. So campus is very involved in the community, and the community is very involved on campus. And I think that our job as an institution, but especially at the Morgard Center, is to make sure that we continue to support that deep collaboration and the kind of shared work.
We're talking with Travis Wright, Faculty Director of the Morgard Center for Public Service at UW-Madison. You mentioned the Wisconsin Idea, this, you know, effort to unite the university and the state around the common good and to lift up Wisconsinites regardless of their background or their class. Is the Wisconsin Idea at risk? What do you hear?
I would say that most faculty came to Wisconsin specifically because of the Wisconsin Idea. I can certainly say that's the case for me. I was teaching at a private institution in another part of the country, and I was excited to come to Wisconsin because I wanted to work at an institution that sort of held this value of doing work to impact the public good and that was deeply committed to making sure that the public interest and the public voice was represented in the work that we're creating. Here on campus, we are sort of doubling down on and reinvesting in the idea that as a public institution, that we have to serve the public. And so I think that sometimes folks have forgotten that. Hmm. Sometimes maybe we haven't done a good enough job of helping people understand all the ways that we're trying to do that. I think maybe sometimes for political reasons, folks have sort of wondered if the help that is being provided is the help that they want. But I think at its core, this institution and my colleagues and the students who work here are deeply committed to leaving the world better than we found it, to sort of making sure that the walls and the barriers that keep people out are removed, so that this really is a public serving institution that all of the public, everyone can touch it, can be impacted by it, can benefit from it. And so, you know, I think when I hear colleagues on campus who are afraid or frustrated or worried in these kind of uncertain times, the Wisconsin Idea is really the thing that we're defending. Like, we want to be a state-serving institution. We want to make sure that Wisconsin is better because we're here and that the whole world is better because we're here. That's why we do this.
It makes me think about the idea of connective labor and this deep interpersonal work that is also part of all public service. And I'm wondering in this moment, how do you see civil service, you know, specifically working for the government as you do your work and you see what's happening with these cuts?
I think that, so I'm speaking as an individual now, sort of, I can't sort of represent the university as I haven't throughout this whole interview. I'm really speaking as an individual. But for me, I think the thing that is most worrying in this moment, one of the many things that's worrying, is that it seems to be that there isn't general consensus about the importance of the public good. It feels like when we have been at our very best as a country, we have agreed that there is a collective we. As someone who has spent his life sort of focused on public service and building civic identity and promoting sort of this idea of community and sort of working in community and being in community and sort of celebrating the public good, I'm very concerned that it seems like increasingly that idea is being contested. You know, I hear more and more people talking about sort of acting in their own self-interest, being able to choose sort of what is best for them, sort of separate from how that choice might impact other people. And I think that that is really concerning, because once we lose that sense of responsibility to each other, the social fabric, the social connection starts to fray, and then we are just pitted against each other on virtually every front. And and so I think that in some ways, this sort of fragmentation of the civil service, this idea that our collective services, our collective efforts can be kind of dismantled, you know, the positions, the work, the structures, those are tremendous losses. And sort of maybe even more profound is the idea that there is no collective we, or that there is no obligation to preserve a public good or public space or public institutions. And so I, you know, I think that I'm deeply concerned about what's happening, because we're, you know, we're firing people who have built their lives around acting in the best interest of others. And when those people, that commitment, that obligation is no longer supported, who have we become, right? Mm-hmm. A society of individuals who just battle each other all the time.
You grew up in a low-income family, and when you talk about the collective we and public good, public service, I wonder how much of that comes from your own background and what you saw growing up.
You know, absolutely. Survival is a collective action. You know, I am only where I am today because I had access to a high-quality public education, right? Like, it was the thing that gave me a pathway to being able to be independent and take care of myself and sort of provide for my own family, and to contribute to my, to other family members and other community members who may not have had the same opportunity. You know, food baskets from the church, 4-H agents who, you know, provided developmental opportunities for me, scholarships that allowed me to continue my higher education when there was no way that my family could have afforded it, have made all the difference in my life. And so I personally can speak to the importance of these social institutions as ways to help people kind of actualize and become more independent and to become contributors to society. And so you know, one of the things that, you know, I am so worried and so deeply concerned about all of the public servants who are losing their jobs. And it is sad to me as someone who kind of really relied on all of those services or many of those services growing up. Because I think not only do the people who lose their jobs miss out, but these are actually the kinds of roles that help people be sort of lifted up, raised up to have their needs met. And so I think that, you know, I know firsthand from my own experience that my life is richer, that I'm more secure, that I'm more stable, that I can be more successful when I have lots of people standing around me, supporting me when I'm embedded in communities and multiple networks. And as those things start to fade away, as those things, as those sources of support become more fractured, who's going to be there to pick people up when they need a helping hand? And sometimes that's exactly what people need to be able to move forward in their lives.
Travis, I want to end on the Wisconsin Idea Conference and what you saw at it, the theme of exchange. And I'm wondering what those exchanges were like and how the people involved looked at the challenges around them.
You know, I haven't gone to a meeting in months where people didn't voice anxiety or frustration or uncertainty or fear. But very quickly, especially at the conference yesterday, that really faded into collective action, sort of strategic thinking, partnership, connection, community. It was very powerful to be in a room of people who were committed to working together, to thinking about how do we share resources? How do we sort of continue to work for the public good, even when it seems to be that there are forces that are seeking to make that more challenging or to dismantle it, you know? So it was really powerful thinking about what can we do together to continue advocating on behalf of the public good, creating connections between campus and community, trying to leave the world better than we found it, you know, even when it's hard, looking for opportunities to celebrate and to appreciate and seek out connection, you know, especially when people feel fragmented. So I felt really hopeful and optimistic that that the very best of us will find a way to connect even when times are hard.
Travis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Travis Wright is faculty director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service at UW-Madison. He talked about the Wisconsin Idea and civil service in light of the Trump administration laying off tens of thousands of federal workers. For disclosure, WPR is a service of UW-Madison.
Coming up, the road to Middle Earth starts in Oshkosh. Find out how a Wisconsin mapmaker created a legendary atlas for The Lord of the Rings.
She started building this huge base map on the floor of the kitchen, using kitchen tiles as scale because it was so big.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings are among the most popular book and movie series ever made, and Wisconsin played a big role in mapping the setting of the books, the world of Middle-earth.
Karen Wynn Fonstad was a cartographer in Oshkosh. She spent years completely mapping J.R.R. Tolkien's world. She eventually published 172 hand-drawn maps in her 1981 Atlas of Middle-earth.
She passed away in 2005 at the age of 59. Her son, Mark, came back to Wisconsin to preserve his mother's work.
We went to see Fonstad's original work in person at UW-Madison's map library, where Mark was working on scanning it all. Her maps took up every table in the room and more.
This table is mostly Tolkien. Mm-hmm. Later on, so like the Shire, and this is
Mordor.
Second Age, yeah, Mordor, Minas Tirith. Like, if you saw movies, that should be all recognizable. This is from The Hobbit. This is the Lonely Mountain.
Is there any of these that is your favorite? I mean, it's hard to say, but...
I don't know. You know, the thing is, the one that's in the absolute worst condition of all is the base map.
Mm-hmm.
That's the original pencil base. That's the one that I remember lying on at age, you know, six or whatever. So probably that one. But that's not the most showy, interesting to look at map. That's just has, like, sentimental value.
After the visit, I talked with Mark and with Karen's husband, Todd, both geographers themselves, about Karen's legacy as a cartographer of fictional worlds. Mark, you and I were just over at the UW Map Library looking at some of the books she worked from. Can you talk about, before we get to the maps themselves, some of the artifacts you have gathered there that she took notes in and notes on?
Yeah, she reread the Tolkien's Lord of the Rings books many, many times, and she would take notes. She would underline phrases and sentences and paragraphs that had specific geographic information, because I think what was in her head for quite a while was the idea of making an enormous map of Lord of the Rings. It was going to be, in order to have everything on it that people would be interested in, such a map would have to be enormous, like something that would fill up an entire wall. Things got even more complicated because Tolkien's son, Christopher, later published the book The Silmarillion in the 70s, and that was also one of those artifacts. I think my dad actually found it at the store and bought it for her.
Yes.
And she went through the whole game again, reread and read that, and realized very quickly that it would be impossible to make one big map that had everything. That's when the idea of the Atlas came about.
Now, Mark, we were just looking at these maps. This is a challenge, right? You're taking text descriptions of a world and some maps drawn by J.R.R. Tolkien's son, Christopher, but translating that print information into a map. Can you talk about how she took it from the page to the maps we'll see and people can see online?
So the first step in any large Atlas project is building something called a base map. This is an enormous map that has just very simple things on it, like where are the coastlines or the rivers or the mountains. And in the case of the Atlas of Middle-earth, that base map, she was lucky because some of that information already existed in maps published in the books. Tolkien had died a couple of years earlier, so she wasn't able to work with him directly. But because she had some of these basic maps, she had a place to start. And from that, she started building this huge base map on the floor of the kitchen, using kitchen tiles as scale because it was so big. And from that, she would then add information that she had read in the books, like the river went this way or the forest was there or not there. And once you complete a base map, then it becomes a lot easier to take smaller areas and make more and more detailed maps. So you kind of go through these books line by line and add information.
And Todd, it's not like she went to the Houghton Mifflin map room and it was working. This is a home project. Could you talk about what this looked like at home when Middle Earth basically invaded your household?
Well, she was very handy. She had a father who operated a shop, sheet metal, and a brother that was very good at diagramming. She learned how to use tools, how to diagram. Of course, everything was by hand. So she actually built a light table with her tools. I think Mark's got it in his house right now. But it was on a drafting table, and she put the light table under that and put it up in our office on second floor. And so it eventually migrated from the kitchen floor to upstairs where she could work till 4 a.m.
And Mark, you grew up surrounded by Middle Earth and other fantasy worlds. So did I. My folks bought a copy of the Atlas. They were huge Lord of the Rings fans, as was I in the day. Todd, can you talk about the reception, how people received this new look at Middle Earth? And I think there is a fandom for her work.
I think she would be utterly surprised, to say the least, to see how this has ballooned. She never did this for money or for fame. It was her passion. Frankly, the royalties didn't come in much until the end of her life. So she didn't do it for that. And it's amazing now it's being published in at least a dozen other countries.
We're talking about Wisconsin cartographer Karen Wynn Fonstad. She's famous for her Atlas of Middle Earth, mapping the works of J.R.R. Tolkien and other fantasy maps. Fonstad passed away 20 years ago this month. We're joined by her husband, Todd Fonstad, and Mark Fonstad, her son, both geographers themselves. Mark, I want to get into the project you're working on now. You've gathered a bunch of the material that your dad had on hand. You're visiting from Oregon in Madison right now, and you're scanning these. Talk about this project.
For many years, both my father and I have thought that it would be really useful and good to find a place to have a long-term archive of my mother's work. And we haven't looked into that in detail yet, but one of the first steps in doing that is to scan and index the map so that you can show people what would exist, what sorts of things would be in such an archive. And it's a little bit of an overwhelming process because, first of all, there's hundreds of maps. Secondly, the maps are built in such a way as they have many layers to them, in a way that you would have layers of a project you're working on in Photoshop, but these are actual physical layers. So any individual map takes multiple scans, and I've been working all week on a large machine to scan some of my mother's maps, and I've barely scratched the surface this week.
When we were just over at the map library, a young cartographer stumbled into our conversation and realized that this was Karen Wynn Fonstad's work strewn all over about the library on tables, and I think he just about passed out. He was very excited.
So are you a fan?
I'm literally trying to make a 21st century follow-up on her map on Numenor from Lord of the Rings.
You want to take a look?
Is this happening right now? I am friends with like six Tolkien mega fans online across the world who would actually, not literally kill, but go to really extreme lengths just to see this, what I blundered into.
She would have been a rock star if she went to, I think, science fiction conventions, fantasy role-playing game conventions. That wasn't her scene, though.
No, in fact, I don't know if that she did really hardly any of that until very late in her life. It wasn't until Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings movies that she kind of got out of her skin and went to some of those conventions. And I think she was quite taken aback by the public interest in her and her work at the time, because when she was working on these projects, mostly in the 1980s, she said, I could have been on a desert island. It was just her and her maps and her light table and the drafting pins, and that was basically it.
And she was in the zone. She would lose complete track of time. She was always on the go. One of her favorite sayings was, can't, never did anything. And she told me many, many times, I've got this neat idea. And she was always thinking, not only atlases, but anything she did, you know, very much with a passion. She was not a patient person.
She was a constantly creative person. Mm-hmm. If she wasn't mapping, she was trying to think of something else creative to do, like I'm going to build shelves in my bedroom today or something like mm-hmm. that. I think she had a kind of innate need.
So I totally get the fascination with fantasy maps. I always have loved them in fiction, games, whatever. And I can't put my finger on why. What is it about fantasy maps that fascinated Karen and so many other people?
That's a hard question. I think it's the same kind of question about why would people read fantasy books anyway. Mm-hmm. And because they're not tied directly to the real world, you can put yourself into it a lot more. And people obviously do that. And it works even better if that fantasy world has rules that you can understand, that, this world is like a little bit like the world you are interested in. And so people spend a lot of time trying to think about these alternate worlds as real.
One of her rules was that she could write about fantasy worlds, but those worlds always had to be based on our reality. You can't go too far out in your fantasies. So there had to be a reflection of the real world here.
That reminds me, speaking of the real world, one of the maps you showed me was the fantasy land mark of Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Yeah. My mother was never a full-time cartographer. She would do projects when they came around. She would do a D&D module now or a book there, but she would also be working as a physical therapist or a lecturer at the university for teaching cartography. And so, for example, she would do projects that to other people might seem more mundane, like let's update the map of Oshkosh, you know, but that was, she was a cartographer. That's what you do.
For years, she was a member of the Oshkosh Planning Commission. She was very civic-minded. She spent a term on the Common Council. She was very active in church. She was always on the go. And it wasn't until, I would say, the last 5 or 6 months of her life that, you know, I never saw her. She didn't slow down until the last few months of her life.
Now, Todd, our producer, Beatrice, is very curious about the dedication to the 1991 edition of the Atlas of Middle-earth to you, the family. It reads, "To Todd, Mark, and Christy, still Pylos, who have shared my 10 years of trials and triumphs from Middle-earth." What does that mean, still Pylos, Todd?
Oh, that's a funny one, because I think she felt that she was slighting the family in some ways by all this work, and She wasn't baking enough pies or bread or whatever.
If you look in the original version of the Atlas of Middle-earth, I can't remember exactly what it says, but instead of still Pylos, it says something to my Pylos.
Okay, that was
a deal. Yes,
so that's
yes.
A revision. So yeah. It's kind of her joke.
How funny.
Yeah.
And Mark, as we wrap up, I mean, very influential map making your mom did, a resource for the film adaptation. I can see when I look at role-playing game maps, the influence of your mom. Can you talk a little bit about her legacy in the world of fantasy map making?
So the world of not only fantasy map making for professional purposes, like you would see in Peter Jackson's movies, but also just a kind of fan fiction level fantasy cartography is a real huge niche these days. There are lots and lots of people making fantasy cartography. And I look back into the sort of history of fantasy cartography, which existed long before Tolkien even, but there's nothing like it is today. Today, there's far more of it. And part of that is the technology exists to make it easier to do. But even with that technology, people spend a lot of time looking at my mother's work as a kind of benchmark. Like, this is how fantasy maps ought to look in some respect. And so if you go ask people who do as a hobby fantasy cartography, my mother's work is often the very first thing that comes up, which is kind of, I think she would be very happy about that.
Absolutely.
And we'll leave it there. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Todd, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That was Mark and Todd Fonstad, geographers and family of the late Wisconsin cartographer Karen Wynn Fonstad of Oshkosh, known for her Atlas of Middle-earth. You can see rare photos of Karen's original work, some of it never published, online at WPR.org.
We talked about Midwestern noir on the show yesterday in the Black Harbor Mystery Series, and we wondered what works you love that are set in the Midwest.
We heard from Jeff in La Crosse, who recommends John Sanford, the author of the Prey series that features a Minneapolis detective.
Jeff also mentioned novelist and crime writer William Kent Kruger with his Cork O'Connor mystery series set in the Northwoods of Minnesota.
Oh, hey, coming up, Thomas Pynchon's new novel set in part in Milwaukee. We can watch for that. So, whether it's mystery, fiction, or thrillers, still time to share your favorite books that have a decidedly Midwestern flavor, email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text. The number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Colleen Leahy, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.